You are listening to the Middle East Institute's podcast series. To support MEI's programs and podcasts, please donate at www.mei.edu. Thank you for your support. So I'd like to welcome you to today's event, The Peace Process, Assessing the Mood on the Ground. I'm Kate Seeley with the Middle East Institute, and we're very fortunate to be hosting today three speakers who have just returned from a trip to Israel and the Palestinian territories, where they met with officials and activists on both sides. The trip was sponsored by the Foundation for Middle East Peace, which, for those of you who are not familiar with it, was established in 1979 to promote a just solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Phil Wilcox, the FMEP president, led the trip, and it included FMEP board chairman Nick Valiotis and board member Arthur Hughes, who between them have decades and decades of experience working on this very thorny issue of the Arab-Israeli crisis. So we're hoping to hear some profound revelations today. Of course, their trip to the region comes at an especially interesting time, corresponding as it does with Secretary Kerry's very dogged efforts to keep a peace process going. While on their trip, they got a better sense of where things are in this process, the progress that has been made, the obstacles that remain, and we look forward to hearing their observations. Very, very briefly, because their bios are in your handout, Mr. Valiotis served as Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs, as well as Ambassador to Egypt and Jordan, and DCM in Tel Aviv. Arthur Hughes served as Ambassador to Yemen among his many posts in the State Department, and later was Director General of the Egypt-Israel Multinational Forces and Observers from 1998 to 2004. And Ambassador Phil Wilcox served as U.S. Consul General in Jerusalem, as well as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs, among many other positions. And though time is short, I've also invited another Foundation for Middle East Peace, an Arab-Israeli expert, Jeff Aronson. He's the Director of Research and Publications at FMEP, where he edits their bi-monthly report on Israeli settlement in the occupied territories, to respond to our speakers and to pose a few trenchant questions. So thank you all very much for your time. It's a real privilege to have you here. Before we get started, I just wanted to acknowledge another very significant person who is coming soon, George Salem. He's an MEI board member, and he's been very active in Washington circles promoting better understanding of the Palestinian cause and advocating a solution to the conflict. Through his foundation, the George and Rhonda Salem Family Foundation, he has made it possible for MEI to program these panels on this topic. This is our sixth panel in this series, and we look forward to many more. So just want to thank George Salem for his support. And now, without further ado, I'd like to invite Ambassador Valiotis to the podium. And I'll get out of here.
Thank you, Kate. You know, looking at some of my friends in the audience, like Hal Saunders, reminds me that we've been involved in this peace process, Hal, since kilometer 101 in September 1973. And, of course, it doesn't get any easier. In the context of the Kerry Initiative, we believed this would be a good time to visit the area and try to understand the situation on the ground. I'll give a brief overview. We spent 4 days in Jerusalem, 2 days in Tel Aviv, during which we met with a variety of Americans, Israelis, and Palestinians, for the most part non-official, but very knowledgeable. The off-the-record personal attack by the Israeli Defense Minister on Secretary of State Kerry provided the media background for those first few days, and we visited Ramallah for talks with PLO, Palestinian Authority officials, Hebron for lunch with the faculty of Hebron University. We met one-on-one and with groups, and it was a fascinating, intensive week. During the first part of the week, there was a dearth of details or even informed speculation of what specifically Kerry had in mind. His staff and his Israeli and Palestinian interlocutors took seriously his request that they keep the discussion secret. However, there was a general assumption that his ultimate framework would be based on the so-called Clinton parameters. And the general view of our interlocutors was that Kerry would fail. Netanyahu would not risk his position in the Likud and his government by putting forward compromise proposals. Abu Mazen was too weak. Not much optimism there. One senior PLO official was openly frustrated that only Abu Mazen and Saab Erekat knew what was going on. Nevertheless, this person was sure Kerry would fail and was pushing a Palestinian Plan B. Go back to the UN. In the context of ignorance of concrete details, much attention was paid to speculation on Kerry's personality. Would he stay the course? Would Obama support him? Etc. Later in the week, several things happened that impacted on the nature of our discussions in Tel Aviv with Israelis. Tom Friedman wrote his op-ed in the New York Times purporting to reveal the Kerry framework. This intensified the public discussion and debate on these issues in the annual meeting in Tel Aviv of an important think tank. Then Netanyahu and Michael Bennett, the settler rep in the cabinet, had a very public bitter spat over the future of settlers in a Palestinian state. And Bennett seemed to have blinked a bit. And later, Martin Indyk was quoted as telling U.S. Jewish leaders that the bulk of the settlers would remain in Israel in any settlement. Now, one result of this combination of factors is that some Israelis began to wonder if perhaps Netanyahu might be willing to take some political risks. We did not have the opportunity to discuss these events with Palestinians. Near the end of our visit, the boycott by the EU of products produced in settlements. You remember the famous Soda Stream ad for the Super Bowl for you football fans. And reports of Dutch and Danish disinvestment in banks operating in settlements was having an impact on the Israeli public and on the body politic. Kerry's warning in Munich about the potential for Israeli isolation helped bring this pot to a boil. Tom Friedman, reporting from Ramallah, devoted his latest column to this subject. And the forthcoming visit of German leader Angela Merkel, who's considered Israel's best friend in Europe, will be important in this respect. What she says, how she says it, the format, the forum. Now, for the millions of Israeli Jews who live in the Sharon Plain and near the sea, this is the bustling part of this Israeli economy, this raises a range of potential serious problems that cannot be solved by a wall. A quick word about the broader picture. Israel's treaties with Egypt and Jordan are holding firm. Israelis shed no tears over the demise of Morsi and the Muslim Brothers, and they appreciate Egypt's efforts to control the Islamic militants who are roaming through the Sinai, and Cairo's tough line on Hamas in Gaza, which seem to be missing, or at least they are invisible factors in the current peace initiative equation. Jordan has an obvious interest in any proposals for security along the Jordan River, any proposals for resolution of the Palestinian refugee problem, and Jerusalem, which has its own special set of problems. So, the treaties with Jordan and Egypt are in good shape, and Israel is far stronger politically, economically, and militarily than ever. a giant, really, among dwarfs. Looks like a good time to make peace from a position of incomparable strength. Phil?
Okay, thank you for bringing us together today. I've not been exactly a beacon of optimism in recent years about solving this terrible 100-year-old conflict. But I have to admit that this week I sense a ray of hope. It's because of Kerry's diplomacy, which coincides with other trends that may just lead to a way out of this tragedy. Israel's secular elites are beginning to speak out, to be more conscious of the threat facing the state of Israel, and for the first time to begin to do something about it. That it coincides with what looks like a revival of the liberal, pragmatic, peace-minded political parties in Israel. The leaders of the two largest of these, Yesh Atid and the Labor Party, have shifted from a reluctance to even mention the peace issue, the territorial issue, the future of Israel's security. But they are doing so now. And Kerry has certainly energized a discussion on what is called the Israeli center and left. That's very encouraging because in recent years, Israel's right wing, which I think does not represent the majority of Israeli citizens, has taken the lead, seized the initiative, in spite of their minority status. Polls still show that 74% of the Israeli people, and indeed the Palestinian people, still want a two-state peace. The problem is, they don't believe it's possible. And I think John Kerry's extraordinary diplomacy is beginning to arouse hopes for peace, perhaps more on the Israeli side than on the Palestinian side. The Palestinians are still in deep despair, but it is encouraging that they are sticking to their policy of nonviolence, and Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, is in his public rhetoric far more moderate and conciliatory than Benjamin Netanyahu and his colleagues. The threat of sanctions, especially the European Union's sanction on all European Union private and public flows to settlements, has had a real effect. And that has shocked the business community, who are now beginning to mobilize. They've created a group called Breaking the Impasse. There's another group in Haifa, the Israeli Peace Initiative, prominent Israeli businessmen who realize that the future of the Israeli economy, if not the state of Israel, is at stake. And that's an important development because they've been quiescent in recent years, satisfied to remain in Tel Aviv and Haifa and make money. The U.S. debate, which is especially important, I think no less important than the debate in Israel and Palestine, is beginning to open up. You will read today in the New York Times by illustrious correspondents like Tom Friedman things that they would not have said 2 or 3 years ago. The mainstream media are beginning to discuss more frankly and candidly this problem, whereas for years they have shied away from doing so. The non-mainstream internet media has been important in this breakthrough toward a more candid public dialogue in this country. The organized American Jewish, Christian, Arab American communities are also speaking out, and there is a profound change, I believe, in the politics of those communities. For years it was AIPAC that was seen as the preeminent American interest group that supported generally the policies of the government of Israel. In recent months, AIPAC has suffered two serious defeats in the Congress. The bill on making war in Syria, and the Iran, the bill which would have imposed conditional sanctions on Iraq. That's a historic development because it has not been since the AWACS battle in Ronald Reagan's era that an American administration has decisively defeated an AIPAC initiative. We also have seen in recent years the rise of a much more articulate and determined, well-organized, liberal and moderate Jewish community. The emergence of AIPAC, the work of Americans for Peace Now, Churches for Middle East Peace, and many others is making a difference.
So they, you mean J Street?
J Street, yes. Did I say AIPAC? I meant J Street. They are making an impact. The doors are increasingly open to them in the White House and the media. And that's a sign of a change, I think. The young, especially the young American Jewish community, staunchly supportive of Israel, is also very critical of Israeli policy. And they are mobilizing. And slowly, I think, having an impact on Congress, although I expect Congress may be the last to become peacemakers. The Israeli security elite are speaking out. The former security Shin Bet chiefs and prominent retired generals, these are people of the highest prestige in Israeli society. And they're beginning to tell the truth about this conflict. I think that's a real sign of change in Israel. But perhaps most important of all has been Kerry's initiative. He's been determined. He has allowed a process of bilateral negotiations to go forward, I think in an effort to give the parties one last chance to do it by themselves. It has failed, and now he is engaged in what I think is the next phase, and that is an American framework. Now, I have to caution against too much optimism about the framework because we haven't seen it, but it looks to me like an American peace plan, whether it is detailed or specific or vaguer, I don't know, and we shall see. I hope it is more specific, and it would transfer the dialogue, transfer the debate to an American proposal, which will be, I believe, even-handed, reflecting the fundamental interests of both Israel and Palestine. And that is galvanizing debate already, and it's a good thing. So we have not seen such activism by any Secretary of State since the days of Jim Baker. We have not seen an American peace plan. The United States for some years now has been reluctant to describe its own policies on issues like settlements, Jerusalem borders, security, and refugees. And that has, I think, weakened our influence, our ability to shape events in the interests of our national security interests and theirs as well. So it's a good thing. Now, there will be no quick solution. This conflict is an ancient one. The whole 40-year project of settlement expansion is deeply embedded. To remove it would be to transform the state of Israel in many ways, but it's still possible, and we sense that sense of possibility in talking to many Israelis. Palestinians are less optimistic, but they too are resilient people with very, very impressive human resources. So I'm convinced that if there is a active, dynamic process led by the United States, both sides will regain hope that they so desperately lack now, and that this could lead the way over time with U.S. energy, persistence, and leadership to a breakthrough in this terrible conflict, and to a reinforcement of American interests, American leadership, which is in trouble in that region, and to rescue these two parties from a terrible future. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming today. As we made our rounds, we heard very often our interlocutors say, well, as I told Martin last week when he was here, and we knew we were talking to the right people then, because we were following, to a large extent, Martin Indyk around, and we would say, well, of course, tell us what you said to Martin, but what did Martin say to you? And they'd say, well, not much. He was asking questions, which is also a good sign. In fact, I should mention here that I think this is the most serious U.S. effort since the first Camp David when Jimmy Carter was president. The most serious, the best prepared, the most intellectually strong, and at the risk of offending some of my friends who are at the second Camp David and elsewhere, I think it's absolutely true. This is a serious effort, the most serious, and maybe it's for a good while anyway, seen as the last best chance. This is certainly the sense we got in the Palestinian territories in Israel. This is the last best chance. So what I want to do is give you my impressions, try to tie it together a little bit and give you a sense, and then specific things we can address in the question and answer period. Well, the impact of carrying what he's doing is just shaking up the situation out there incredibly. And this comes after a time when the Israeli left was dispirited and basically disorganized and thinking about other things. You remember the last Israeli election was not on peace issues at all. And the Israeli right basically had a free ride. They were calling the tune, even though, as Phil said, they represent a minority. There was some loss in the Knesset elections to Likud, as we all know. But the settlement expansion continued. The population of Israeli Jews east of the Green Line continued. The barrier had its result in reducing terrorism almost to nil. The Netanyahu government and others were able to diss our president, which irritated me. You might not know it here, but after the failed attempt in the first term, there were signs in Israel, we have won, we have defeated the President of the United States, which I thought was bad for Israel, certainly bad for the United States as far as I'm concerned, but I thought it was bad for Israel too. But now the Kerry Initiative has really shaken things up, and people are being forced, they're being pressed, and they know that, I think now it's clear that Kerry is not going to give up. And the president's inclusion in the State of the Union message, a short paragraph, which Senator Schumer is taking credit for, by the way, I'm told by some newsies, was important. But even more important is what the president is reported to have said yesterday morning at the prayer breakfast, which I found out in the Israeli press, not in the American press, interestingly enough, that he praised John Kerry by name, who was there, for his diplomacy, his passion to proceed. And I think that will help dispel further any cynical notion that was current even when we were out there, that the president was holding back, waiting to see if there's success. Of course, success will have many fathers, and the president would be number one, or failure, he could disappear. I never really believed that from what I knew and from discussions I had with some of the team. But I think what he said yesterday will further absolutely dispel that notion. So it's clear that the Israeli and Palestinian leadership are going to be pressed to make some decisions. And two words that we heard very often when we were out there was courage and guts. And whether courage and guts are going to come to play, I frankly don't know. Because as Isaac Herzog said in an interview the other day, this will require same basic decisions that will change things, markably, both in Israel and a new state of Palestine, if that comes about. Now, on the right, as I said, disarray. They don't quite know how to act. They're bickering among each other to the point where you might have noticed last week, Prime Minister Netanyahu basically told his cabinet to cool it. which in good normal Israeli fashion they ignored. It's always a very vigorous discussion, which is to their credit, absolutely. I enjoyed it when I lived there for 3 years, and then when I was going there about 4 or 5 times a year when I was the Director General of the Israeli Peacekeeping, I enjoyed very much. In fact, it's a little bit like Madeline and Carville. I had some very close Israeli friends, and I could get the whole scope of it by going to dinner with the two of them, because they would cover both sides of the argument. One part of this, the married couple would argue left and one would argue right. So I didn't have to really spend a lot of time going around talking to other people. Now, just to mention, I don't think there's any indication that he would use it, but there is another option. We heard a lot, too, that in the Knesset, there were between 75 and 80 votes, 120 in the Knesset, as you know, who would vote to very, very seriously enter into negotiations with the Palestinians on a peace deal. In fact, Isaac Herzog, you know, is the leader, the new leader of the Labor Party, he said he has 59 in a peace camp in the Knesset now. Now, the Palestinian side, a lot of pessimism, a lot of not knowing what is going on. We also heard people say only Mahmoud Abbas, president, and Saeb Erekat, the lead negotiator, really know what's going on. They're not telling others what is happening. I think they're being very cautious because they know if there is much to be said publicly about where they might go on these issues, they will face very serious difficulties, right of return, for example, because there is no good solution from the Palestinian perspective on right of return. That's my view in any event. So they're being very careful, but Phil mentioned that President Abbas is being very statesmanlike. He's being very positive, constructive. The long interview that was in the Times last week with, I think it was Bill Kirshner and Tom Friedman, he played the role of a statesman, moderate, said what he expected, and I think actually that's what he believes as well, from what I know from being out there on the ground. So that's all of the good. And Saeb Erekat is given the role of being the heavy after he met with Kerry here a week and a half ago. He said, no progress, nothing good happening. So where now? I don't think we're at the moment of truth yet. Maybe a kind of a preliminary moment of truth. I'm not sure what the Secretary Kerry is going to put on the table with regarding a framework. But my own view is, and I'm not sure my colleagues even agree with me, but is that there'll be enough space in the framework that it would be very hard for either side to want to disengage. And also, neither side, of course, wants to take blame for the collapse of this effort, for their own domestic reasons and also for the U.S. reasons. Because I think, as Phil indicated, that Prime Minister Netanyahu is in a different position here. After having won the first round, I think now he has not won this round. It's not only the elements going on in Israel, but I think here in the United States that Phil referred to. And I didn't check their website, but I saw a reference this morning that AIPAC issued a statement yesterday that now is not the time to pursue any additional sanctions on Iran. And Chairman Menendez had issued a statement shortly before that, and so some indication that they were coordinated, which wouldn't surprise me. But in any event, so the dynamics have changed, and he's going to have to be very much more careful than he has in the past. And I think that's all of the good. As an American, I think that's all of the good. And as an American who believes in it, that a two-state solution is the best outcome, best possible outcome, I think that's all of the good as well. Just two quick things. One on security. I spent a lot of time dealing with security, not only when I was at defense, where Israel was my main client, and then as the director general appointed by Israel and Egypt of the MFO, the Israel-Egypt Peacekeeping, thought a lot about defense, thought a lot about what they could do in the context of a two-state solution. And I think that what I understand General Allen and Secretary Kerry came up with is a workable solution that would provide Israel with the required security for them to enter into an agreement which would remove the IDF from the Jordan Valley after a transition period. It was 3 years, Egypt, Israel. They've talked about five. President Abbas now has talked about five in his interview. But one thing has not been talked about much in the press, and that is the nature of the peacekeeping operation that would be needed. This would not be one that would be responsible only for monitoring and verification, but would need a very robust mandate and rules of engagement that would allow them to interdict, intercept, arrest, suppress. A really tough mandate. But I think that the United States and NATO forces could accept that kind of a mandate and do the job. The other thing, very quickly, I was also involved in what has been known as the Canadian Initiative, the Jerusalem Old City Initiative, that produced a very deeply considered and well-thought-out plan option for the Old City of special regime, but one created by Israel and the New State of Palestine, so it would not be imposed, nor would it be internationalization, one of the old discredited ideas. But if anyone wants to blow up the talks or cause a real rupture, it would be to do something on the Temple Mount Haramah Sharif. So one needs to be very careful, and I'm sure the parties are keeping a very careful eye on that. So where are we now? The parties are being challenged. They're going to have to make some decisions, because I'm convinced that the Secretary Kerry and the President are not going to back away from this. And as I said, we heard the words courage and guts a lot when we were out there. Whether we're going to see him, I don't know. But I must say, I feel better now, having been there, than I felt before we went about the prospects. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, gentlemen, for an interesting and well-informed overview of current events in that part of the world. We have about a half hour now, which I'll open for questions in just 1 minute. I'd just like to make an observation here that I hope will stimulate a response from one of you. During the Annapolis talks, we know that there was serious engagement on a bilateral basis between Israeli and Palestinian negotiators. This was a dialogue that the energy for which was present on both sides. It seems from the outside, in contrast, that the discussions over the last 9 months have been essentially bilateral discussions between one of the parties and the United States rather than between the parties themselves. Each of the principal parties has been most interested to win the U.S. over to its view of things rather than to negotiate among themselves to try to find points of agreement. Based on your observations, at what stage would you see the beginning of a truly bilateral engagement, perhaps along the lines most recently expressed during the Annapolis era and certainly before? Or are we going to see a U.S. role as absolutely vital and orchestrating discussions that are between the U.S. and each party without essentially interaction between the parties, an enhanced view of proximity talks, if you will? And then I'll open it up to question. I think what you want us to stand up and appear here, is that right?
I invite Phil and Art and Nick to the podium to, you'll be speaking into these mics. And,
so I'll stand aside.
Yeah.
Why do people think?
Nations generally make peace when they believe they have a shared interest in peace. I'm not persuaded that the current Israeli coalition under Benjamin Netanyahu believes that they have a common interest with the
Palestinians in making peace. I believe their interest lies in dominating, controlling permanently a land which some of them feel is sacred Jewish land, which others want to dominate for ideological reasons. So I think that the parties will continue to try to negotiate with the United States instead of each other until there is a change in the Israeli government. Now, the change would not necessarily mean the overthrow of Benjamin Netanyahu. He is a man who has a long ideological history. He is also known as a politician who will grasp at opportunities to enhance his own leadership. There is talk in Israel now that there are well over 61 mandates in the Knesset that would support a comprehensive peace agreement that and it's not out of question that it might happen, that there would be a shake-up in the current coalition, a shedding of one of the most dedicated and extremist political parties, and to bring in the Labor Party or the Yesh Atid Party, or both, to create a new, very different, moderate, centrist, peace-minded government. If that were the case, I think the Israeli government and the Palestinian government would take a lot more interest in negotiating between themselves. In previous important Middle East negotiations, there has been that commonality of interest. There isn't right now, but there could be. That's the way I see it.
I think that once the Kerry framework is made public, the idea would be that the Palestinians and Israelis would engage bilaterally. And I also believe that that would break down rather quickly, at least in the initial stages, and it would require an American presence, bridging proposals, what have you. So I don't think we're going to see the Americans backing out, nor should they in this.
Well, it's often said that they can't do it themselves, but there are also those, and one hears the saw occasionally in Israel, that we do it best when the Americans get out, and they refer to Oslo, for example. I don't think they can do it themselves. There are certain things they have to do themselves when it comes down to some of the fine points of negotiations if they ever get there, but I think the U.S. has got to be there.
Thank you. We'll take a question. Yes, sir, up front. You've got a mic coming to you here. So perhaps you could stand up, make it easier for everyone to.
Thank you. Mike Kurtzig. You talked about meeting with the Palestinians, and you said that there's a shift in Israel. Seems to be a political shift in Israel, maybe the United States. But a major stumbling block is Hamas in Gaza. Did you have a chance to talk to any of these people and to see if they're going to change their position a little bit, stop lobbing rockets over my brother's head, among other things, but whether that has changed, whether that is now would be the major stumbling block?
I can't tell you what Hamas attitudes are. But from what we've been told by Palestinians on the West Bank, Gazans are rather disillusioned by the Hamas leadership. So they suggest strongly that the attitudes of the public in Gaza would be reflective of the general attitudes in the West Bank. That's if you have a referendum on a peace plan, that the Gazans would reflect the views of the West Bankers that if it's reasonable, let's get the Israelis off our backs. You have to understand that these people are living in an open-air prison. I don't know how you can describe it any other way. Now, maybe that's a hopeful and unrealistic feeling, but that's what they've told us. On the question of Palestinian attitudes expressed in a referendum, I think people are reasonably certain that a good majority of Palestinians would support a two-state solution as negotiated by their leaders. But that doesn't necessarily include the refugees who live outside of the West Bank. And, are they going to be included? Pretty hard to see how the people in Yarmouk could be included. But nevertheless, these are things they're going to have to work out. Right now, what you've got is a West Bank first negotiation. My personal view is we should have been trying to do this some years ago and come up with something good enough to attract the Gazans. I hope that's what happens this time.
I don't think a permanent viable peace between Israel and Palestine could be possible, nor could a wholesome, viable Palestinian state come into being if it is cut off from the other part of Palestine, cut off from the Mediterranean Sea. Hamas is a political party. If there is an emerging peace agreement supported by the Palestinian Authority and the people of the West Bank, I am certain that Hamas would have no choice. They would have to support it for fear of losing whatever constituency they have retained. And their constituency now today is waning. So Hamas, yes, indeed, it's an obstacle. They will make trouble as these, if Kerry's initiative proceeds, as I think it will. But in the end, they'll have to yield because they are in a minority and they would not stand in the way of the rescue of the Palestinian people and the emergence of a Palestinian state.
Just to agree, given what's happened in Egypt, it's hard to see that Hamas would have any other really realistic option under a circumstance in which there was real progress toward a Palestinian state.
Yes, sir.
I'm Bob Blake. You all have discussed a little bit how what you've been seeing and hearing fits in with what's happening in the United States and so forth on Iran and Syria and Egypt. In other words, the whole big picture. What do you think Obama might have in mind by pushing hard as against what is the real, quite openly said, something on nuclear with Iran must have the highest priority?
Well, I don't think the administration is ignoring Iran. My own personal view is they've done a very good job. As far as Egypt and Syria, I guess if I were back in government, I would first ask the question, what can I usefully do in Egypt to promote freedom of expression, for example? For example, the 18 journalists who are being prosecuted for various crimes of disagreeing with the military in Egypt. Syria, can I do anything else except try to feed and provide some relief to the hundreds of thousands who are suffering? And then I would conclude there's, frankly, not all that much I can do except in the humanitarian field in Syria. But in Palestine and Israel, there is something I can do. And therefore, I really applaud the Kerry initiative. And I hope the president carries it out. Doesn't mean you're going to ignore the rest of the world out there. But there's only so much you can do. Here you can have a major impact. In Iran you can have a major impact if they do walk back from their nuclear program.
I agree with Nick that the U.S. has a vastly closer relationship with the Israelis and the Palestinians and a much larger capacity to use American diplomacy to solve their conflict. We lack that knowledge, that ability in Egypt and in Syria. I think that a resolution of the Iranian nuclear issue would lift a burden of fear from the Israeli public, and I think that the Israeli public does support a negotiated solution and not a new war. It's very interesting that the most prestigious and respected retired military people, retired Mossad officers, say that a war between Israel and Syria would be crazy, and that a war between the U.S. and Syria would cause nothing.
Iran
and the United States would bring nothing but further grief. So, yes, we are capable, given our past history, of being helpful in Israel and Palestine. We have shown that in the last 60 years of conflict, if we have a policy of our own that reflects the basic needs of the negotiating parties, if we persevere, if we are strong and patient, that we can prevail. And I think we need to have a little more confidence in our own country to do this, and there is precedent that proves that.
Yep, nothing to add, thank you.
Yes.
Hi, Edison Dick, FMEP Director. I'd like to hear some comment on what Tom Friedman called the third infantata, the financial and economic possible, you know, tightening the screws in Israel and how that may affect the whole negotiations.
Well, both Phil and I tried to address that to some extent. I don't know how many of you in the audience have had the experience of actually living in Israel and watching this incredibly unique interaction between the public, the media, and the government. It's something that I've never experienced in any other country. This issue has been there, but largely ignored until rather recently. And then several developments, which we mentioned, the Kerry statement, the EU boycott of settlements, the Danish and Norwegian banks,
Dutch
disinvesting, the threats of more, the visit of Angela Merkel, Tom Friedman's article, which you can bet is being discussed in every cafe, for coffee, every dinner party. That's where public opinion goes, and in the media in Israel. I think it's very important. It may be leading to a tipping point in the public views.
The Palestinians have one other asset, which I think as a last resort they may use, and that is going to the United Nations again. They are reluctant to do this because they know that it would offend the United States. It would be very costly to the United States because our Congress has passed a law which declares that we shall withdraw from any UN specialized agencies that admits the Palestinians as members. And that would cause, of course, havoc for us, so we are opposed to this policy. There is a need, I think, in the future, if this American initiative continues, and I believe it will,
to begin to develop more public diplomacy. Peace is not made by diplomats in secret conversations. Ultimately, it is made by the people, and the societies of both Israel and Palestine will have to be committed to peace if it is to succeed. And so at some stage, I think Kerry will begin to turn a corner to begin to engage the United States more directly with the Israeli public and the Palestinian public. It's already happening in a way, but we need to build this in as a very important component of our diplomacy as this thing moves forward.
Let me see. Yeah, there is a nightmare scenario that we can think of. If Kerry's talks fail, everything goes back the way it was. Everyone's discouraged. And, you know, and I don't think it's going to lead to violence because Palestinians are just too tired of all this nonsense pressure. But it could lead them to go, all right, let's go, and, you know, every year we'll go up to the UN. Maybe we'll go into a new specialized agency. And the United States has to pull out. How stupid. And then Israel is labeled continually as the negative black mark. That would be a terrible scenario. Which could happen, but I hope it doesn't, for everyone's benefit.
I think it's important to draw a distinction between what has become known as BDS, boycott, disinvestment, sanction, on the one hand, and other kinds of attempts to, which give the impression at trying to delegitimize the existence of Israel as a state. I think it's very important to distinguish between the two and keep clear, because they are two different things. BDS is aimed at Israeli investments and activities in the occupied territories. That is to say, products that are produced there and labeled made in Israel, which factually is not true, because even Israel doesn't claim that the territories are part of Israel yet, although there have been bills introduced in the Knesset. But my way of thinking, that is a perfectly legitimate, peaceful way to put pressure on Israel because the products aren't made in Israel. Where it gets a little more complicated is disinvestment from banks, because the major Israeli banks all have bank branches in the territories, in the settlements. And the words I heard from Israelis were that that's more concerning than the question of boycotts on products made in the territories. On the other hand, the question of delegitimization, I think, is a little bit more loaded and dangerous, because this is an attack on the basic Israeli-Jewish narrative of Israel. And, of course, there is a kind of battle of two narratives. The twain shall never meet. But the narratives are extremely important in the psychology and the politics of both sides. And therefore, attacking the basic narrative of either side, I think, is a dangerous proposition. It's one thing to maintain your own narrative, but another thing to attack the narrative of the other. They'll have to address the narrative when it comes down to address some of the core issues of the conflict, of course.
Yes, right there.
Yes, hi. Phil, you mentioned that peace will ultimately come not through secret diplomacy, but through the people themselves. In your travels, did you encounter any influence or hear anything about the Arab Peace Initiative, the Israeli Peace Initiative, or even the Geneva Accords, and if that is being resurgent?
Yes. I think the Geneva Accords is one of the models or templates, as are the Clinton parameters, for a peace agreement. And to their credit, the Geneva Initiative people are still working. They've institutionalized it. They are publicizing it.
The Arab League initiative, I think, is quite popular among the pragmatic center in Israel, although it is feared by the far right because it is directed at an Israeli withdrawal from the occupied territories in exchange for peace. There are many, many international and American private organizations that are trying to promote dialogue. This is a very old institution whereby Israelis and Palestinians listen to each other, ultimately begin to accept each other, and to mobilize themselves for a joint approach to peacemaking. That alone has not been enough to break this impasse, but it's very, very important. And I applaud these American groups who send teams over to Israel and Palestine annually. I think there's a payoff there and that they should be supported.
I think we have time for one last question. Two. Okay. Please.
Concerning Israel's need for security, perceived need for security under a peace agreement, Netanyahu was asked the question, who do you trust? And his response was, I trust my own army. That seems to me a fairly strong statement, you know, presumably precluding the notion of the U.S. or the international community involvement, you know, particularly along the Jordan Valley. And I'm just wondering how serious you take that and what it implies, you know, for moving forward.
If I were Kerry, I'd take it as an opening position. Certainly would not be an acceptable final position. If that means the Israeli army permanently stationed along the Jordan River, total non-starter. But when you deal with right-wing Israeli governments, you always have to be careful on the subject of security to distill real security concerns out of a mix that includes strong ideological and religious considerations.
Why does no one ever talk about the security of the Palestinians?
Allow me. both sides have legitimate security concerns. Israel has legitimate security concerns, and Palestine does too. Frankly, when I talked with the peace team, I pointed that out. I also pointed out the danger in talking only to the Israelis about peace terms, security arrangements, and then going to the Palestinians and saying, well, this is kind of what we need to do for the Israelis. That's been done before, and it's a stupid thing to do, and it's a mistake. And I hope that the present guys have not done it that way. But I agree with Nick. It's an opening position. The other thing one hears is that we have to defend ourselves by ourselves. Continue to do it. Well, but the facts are they're not. Israel is not defending itself by itself now. Without the American support, they'd be in a quite different security situation. I'm not only talking about funding, but I'm talking about all kinds of equipment and so forth. What are the planes they fly? The 73 war, we all remember very well, the resupply issues and requirements. And I don't think the United States has ever let Israel down when it comes down to their security needs. The American commitment to Israel on security is to maintain the qualitative edge. And it's done it very, very well to the present day. In fact, the qualitative edge now is probably wider than it's been since after the 67 war. There have been no complaints with respect to the Obama administration regarding the security support. But frankly, it's not true now, and it's not necessary then. Ways can be found to ensure Israeli security and to ensure Palestinian security. And we heard from some Palestinians that they have needs too. I mean, what security needs do they have? I mean, one can analyze that, and they have fair security concerns. I mean, to me, one of the biggest problems that will need to be solved is now it's the IDF that controls the West Bank. It's under military law, not civilian law, which means that the Israelis can do virtually anything they want, subject only to international law and their own ethical and moral considerations. But some of the things that are doing go beyond those things, as published by Israeli former soldiers who served and did some of those things. But the hardest thing will be to get Israel to accept that they no longer have total freedom of action to do whatever they want in the Palestinian territories in a new state of Palestine. And that will be a big psychological barrier that will have to be broken through. But I think it can be broken through if one deals only with the military and not with the political side.
I think the U.S. must remain very sensitive to the security of the state of Israel. But the real threat to the security of the state of Israel is its occupation of another nation. And that is simply untenable in the 21st century because it violates all universal attitudes toward human rights, human freedom, and self-determination. That is the real security problem. Of course, Israel, like all nations, has other security problems, and they should be attended to. But the fact that the United States has focused in its foreign policy toward Israel over the last 40 years on bolstering Israel's security, I think has given them a sense of false confidence that a military force is the key to security. It is not, and I think history confirms that.
One word about the Palestinians. It seems to me their most pressing security issue is to get rid of the foreign military occupation so they can begin to live normal lives.
And I think with that, ladies and gentlemen, we'll close out for today. Sorry, I think we're out of time. So I appreciate your attendance today. Thank you for coming, and keep an eye out for us in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.